right hand pocket is the slim instrument Daddy has given him, a hypodermic with a plastic cap on the needle tip. Scott doesn't need his daddy to tell him it's a fragile mechanism. If there's a struggle, it may break. Daddy offered to put it in a little white cardboard box that once held a fountain pen, but getting the hypo out of the box would take an extra couple of seconds at least, and that might mean the difference between life and death if he succeeds in getting the thing chained to the post over to Booyah Moon. In Booyah Moon, there will be no daddy with a .30-06 deer gun. In Booyah Moon, there will be just him and the thing that slipped into Paul like a hand into a stolen glove. Just the two of them, on top of Sweetheart Hill. The thing that used to be his brother lies sprawled with its back against the center post and its legs splayed. It's naked except for Paul's undershirt. Its legs and feet are dirty. Its flanks are caked with shit. The pie plate, licked clean even of grease, lies by one grimy hand. The extra-large hamburger that was on it disappeared down the Paul thing's gullet in a matter of seconds, but Andrew Landon agonized over the patty's creation for almost half an hour, chucking his first effort out into the night after deciding he'd loaded too much of the stuff into it. The stuff is white pills that look almost exactly like the Tums and Rolaids Daddy sometimes takes. The one time Scott asked Daddy where they came from, Daddy said, "Why don't you shut your goddamn mouth, Curious George, before I shut it for you?" And when Daddy says something like that, you take the hint if you've got any sense. Daddy ground the pills up with the bottom of a water glass. He talked as he worked, maybe to himself, maybe to Scott, while below them the thing chained to the printing press roared monotonously for its supper.
"Easy enough to figure when you want to knock him out," Daddy said,
looking from the pile of white powder to the ground meat.
"Be easier still if I wanted to kill the troublesome motherfucker, eh? But no, I don't want to do that. I just want to give him a chance to kill the one that's still all right. More fool am I. Well, smog it and smuck it. God hates a coward."
He used the side of his pinky with surprising delicacy to separate a little line of white powder from the pile. He pinched some up, sprinkled it onto the meat like salt, kneaded it in, then pinched up a tiny bit more and kneaded that in too. He didn't bother much with what he called hot cuisine when it came to the thing downstairs, said it would be happy to eat its dinner raw, still warm and shaking on the bone for that matter. Now Scott stands beside his daddy, hypo in pocket, watching the dangerous thing loll against its post, snoring with its upper lip pulled back. It's grizzling from the corners of its mouth. The eyes are half open, but there's no sign of its irises. Scott can see only the gleaming, glabrous whites.
"Only the whites ain't white anymore," he thinks. "Go on, goddamn you," Daddy says, giving him a thump on the shoulder. "If you're gonna do it, then go on before I lose my nerve or drop with a sweet mother heart attack. Or do you think he's shamming, only pretending to be out?"
Scott shakes his head. The thing's not trying to fool them, he would feel that, and then looks at his father wonderingly.
"What?"
Daddy asks irritably.
"What's on your mind besides your smucking hair?"
"Are you really..."
"Am I really scared? Is that what you want to know?"
Scott nods, suddenly shy.
"Yeah, to fucking death. Do you think you's the only one? Now close your mouth and do it if you're gonna. Let's have an end to this."
He will never understand why his father's acknowledgement of fear makes him feel braver. All he knows is that it does. He walks toward the center post. He touches the barrel of the hypo inside his pocket one more time as he goes. He reaches the outer arc of turds and steps over it. The next step takes him over the inner ring and into what you might call the thing's den. Here the smell is intense. Not the odor of shit or even hair and skin, but rather of fur and pelt. The thing has a penis that is bigger than Paul's was. Paul's peach-fuzzy groin has thatched in with the thing's coarse, dense pubic hair, and the feet at the end of Paul's legs, those legs are the only things that still look the same, have a queerly turned-in look, as if the bones in his ankles are warping. Boards left out in the rain, Scott thinks. It's not quite nonsense. Then his eyes return to the thing's face, to its eyes. The lids are still mostly fallen, and there's still no sign of irises, only bloody whites. The breathing is likewise unchanged, The dirty hands continue to lie limp, the palms up as if in surrender. Yet Scott knows he has entered the red zone. It will not do to hesitate now. The thing will scent him and come awake at any second. This will happen in spite of the stuff Daddy put in the hamburger. And so if he can do it, if he can take the thing that has stolen his brother. Scott continues forward, walking on legs he can now barely feel. Part of his mind is absolutely convinced that he's going to his death. He won't even be able to boom away, not once the paw thing takes hold of him. Nevertheless, he steps within range of its grasp, into the most intimate concentration of its wild stench, and puts his hands on its naked, clammy sides. He thinks, "Paul, come with me now." And, "Bool, booyah, booyah moon, sweet water the pool." And for just one heartbreaking, heartbroken moment, it almost happens. There's the familiar sense of things starting to rush away. Up comes the hum of insects and the delicious daytime perfume of the trees on Sweetheart Hill. Then the thing's long nailed hands are around Scott's neck. It opens its mouth and roars the sounds and smells of Booyah Moon away on a draft of carrion breath. To Scott, it feels like someone has just shot a flaming boulder into the delicate forming grid of his what? It's not his mind that takes him to that other place. Not precisely his mind. And there's no time to think about it further because the thing has got him. It's got him. Everything Daddy was afraid of has come to pass. Its mouth has come unhinged in some nightmarish fashion that confounds sanity, seeming to drop its lower jaw all the way to its beast bone, breastbone, contorting the dirty face into something from which every last vestige of Paul and humanity itself has disappeared. This is the bad gunky with its mask off. Scott has time to think, "It's gonna take my whole head in a single bite like a lollipop." That monstrous mouth yawns, the red eyes sparkle in the naked glow of the hanging light bulbs, and Scott is going nowhere except to his death. The thing's head draws back far enough to bang the post, then lashes forward. But Scott has once again forgotten about Daddy. Daddy's hand comes out of the dim, seizes the paw thing by the hair, and somehow wrenches the head backward. Then Daddy's other hand appears, thumb curled around the stock of his deer gun where the stock is thinnest, forefinger hugging the trigger. He socks the gun's muzzle into the shelf of the thing's upslanted chin. "Daddy, no!" Scott shrieks. Andrew Landon pays no attention, can afford to pay no attention. Although he's gotten a huge handful of the thing's hair, it's ripping free of his fist just the same. Now it's bellowing, and its bellows sound dreadfully like one word. Like Daddy.
"Say hello to hell, you bad gunky motherfucker,"
Sparky Landon says, and pulls the trigger. The .30-06's discharge is deafening in the enclosed space of the cellar. It will ring in Scott's ears for 2 hours or more. The thing's shaggy back hair flies up, as if in a sudden gust of breeze, and a large splash of crimson paints the leaning center post. The thing's legs give a single crazy cartoon kick and go still. The hands around Scott's neck twitch momentarily tighter, and then fall palms up, flump, onto the dirt. Daddy's arm encircles Scott and lifts him up.
"Are you all right, Scoot? Can you breathe?"
"I'm okay, Daddy. Did you have to kill him?"
"Are you brainless?"
Scott hangs limp in the circle of his father's arm, unable to believe it's happened, even though he knew it might. He wishes he could faint. Wishes, a little anyway, that he could die himself. Daddy gives him a shake.
"He was gonna kill you, wasn't he?"
"Yeah."
"You're fucking A, he was. Christ, Scotty. He was ripping his own sweet mother hair out by the roots to get at you. To get at your smoggin' throat."
Scott knows this is true, but he knows something else as well.
"Look at him, Daddy. Look at him now."
For a moment or two longer, he hangs from the circle of his father's arm like a rag doll or a puppet whose strings have been cut. Then Landon slowly lowers him down, and Scott knows his father is seeing what Scott wanted him to see. Just a boy. Just an innocent boy who has been chained in the cellar by his lunatic father and dog's body younger brother, then starved until he's rack thin and covered with sores. A boy who has struggled so pitifully hard for his freedom that he actually moved the steel post and the cruelly heavy table to which he has been chained. A boy who has lived 3 nightmare weeks as a prisoner down here before finally being shot in the head.
I see him, Daddy says,
and the only thing grimmer than his voice is his face.
Why doesn't he look like before, Daddy? Why?
Because the bad gunky's gone, you numbskull.
And here's an irony even a badly shaken 10-year-old can appreciate, at least a bright one like Scott. Now that Paul lies dead, chained to a post in the cellar with his brains blown out, Daddy has never looked or sounded saner.
And if anyone else sees him like this, I'll be for either the state prison in Waynesburg or locked in that smuckin' nut barn up in Reedville. That's if they don't lynch me first. We'll have to bury him. Although ain't gonna be a bitch kitty with the ground like it is, hard as iron.
Scott says, I'll take him, Daddy.
How you gonna take him? You couldn't take him when he is alive.
He doesn't have the language to explain that now it will be no more than going there dressed in his clothes, which he always does. That anvil weight, bank vault weight, piano weight, is gone from the thing chained to the post. The thing chained to the post is now no more than a green husk you strip off an ear of corn. Scott just says, I can do it now.
You're a little bag of boasting wind,
Daddy says, but he leans the deer gun against the table with the printing press on it. He runs a hand through his hair and sighs. For the first time, he looks to Scott like a man who could get old.
Go on, Scott. Might as well give her a try. Can't hurt.
But now that there's no actual danger, Scott is bashful.
Turn around, Daddy.
What the fuck you say?
There's a potential beating in Daddy's voice, but for once Scott doesn't back down. It isn't the going part that bothers him. He doesn't care if Daddy sees that. What he's bashful about is Daddy seeing him take his dead brother in his arms. He's going to cry. He feels it coming on already. Like rain on a late spring afternoon when the day has been hot with the foretaste of summer.
Please, he says in his most placating voice. Please, Daddy.
For a moment, Scott is quite sure that his father is going to rush across the cellar to where his surviving son stands, with his tripled shadow racing beside him on the rock walls, and backhand him. Perhaps knock him spang into his big brother's dead lap. He's been backhanded plenty of times, and usually even the thought of it makes him cringe. But now he stands straight between Paul's splayed legs, looking into his father's eyes. It's hard to do that, but he manages. Because they have survived a terrible passage together, and will have to keep it between themselves forever.
Shh.
So he deserves to ask, and he deserves to look in Daddy's eyes while he waits for his answer. Daddy doesn't come at him. Instead, he takes a deep breath, blows it out, and turns around.
You'll be telling me when to wash the floors and scrub out the toilet next, I guess, he grumbles. I'll give you a count of 30, Scoot.
21. I'll give you a count of 30 and then I'm turning around again, Scott tells her. I'm pretty sure that's how he finished it, but I never heard because by then I was gone off the face of the earth. Paul, too, right out of his chains. I took him with me as easy as ever once he was dead. Maybe easier. I bet Daddy never finished counting to 30. Hell, I bet he never even got started before he heard the clink of chains or maybe the sound of air rushing in to fill the space where we'd been, and he turned around and he saw that he had the cellar all to himself. Scott has relaxed against her. The sweat on his face and arms and body is drying. He has told it. Gotten the worst of it out of him, sicked it up. The sound, she says. I wondered about that, you know. If there was a sound under the willow tree when we, you know, came back out.
When we boomed.
Yes, when we, that.
When we boomed, Lisey, say it.
When we boomed.
Wondering if she's crazy. Wondering if he is. And if it's catching.
Now he does light another cigarette, and in the match glow his face is honestly curious.
What did you see, Lisey? Do you remember?
Doubtfully, she says, There was a lot of purple slanting down a hill, and I had a sense of shade, like there were trees right behind us, but it was also quick, no more than a second or two. He laughs and gives her a one-armed hug. That's Sweetheart Hill you're talking about. Sweetheart? Paul named it that. There's dirt all around those trees, soft, deep. I don't think it's ever winter there. And that's where I buried him. That's where I buried my brother. He looks at her solemnly and says, Do you want to go see, Lisey? 22. Lisey had been asleep on the study floor in spite of the pain. No, she hadn't been asleep, because you couldn't sleep with pain like this, not without medical help. So what had she been? Mesmerized. She tried the word on for size and decided it fit just about perfectly. She had slid into a kind of doubled, maybe even trebled, recall. Total recall. But beyond this point, her memories of the cold guest room where she'd found him catatonic, and those of the two of them in the creaky second-floor bed at the Antlers, these memories 17 years older but even clearer, were blotted out. Do you want to go see Lisey? He had asked her. Yes, yes. But whatever had come next was drowned in brilliant purple light, hidden behind that curtain, and when she tried to reach for it, authority voices from childhood, good ma's, dandies, all her big sisters, clamored in alarm. No, Lisey, that's far enough, Lisey. Stop there, Lisey. Her breath caught. Had it caught as she lay there with her love? Her eyes opened. They had been wide as he took her in his arms, of that she was sure. Bright morning June light, 21st century June light, replacing the staring, glaring purple of a billion lupin. The pain of her lacerated breast flooded back in with that light. But before Lisey could react to either the light or the panicky voices commanding her to go no farther, someone called to her from the barn below, startling her so badly that she came within a thread of screaming. If the voice had stopped short at Mrs., she would have. Mrs. Landon? A brief pause. Are you up there? No trace of Border South in that voice, only a flat Yankee drawl that turned the words into, Are you up there? And Lisey knew who was down there. Deputy Alston. He'd told her he'd keep checking back, and here he was, as promised. This was her chance to tell him, hell yes, she was up here. She was lying on the floor bleeding because the black prince of the Incunks had hurt her. Alston had to take her to Nosopa with the flashers and the siren going. She needed stitches in her breast, a lot of them, and she needed protection, needed it around the clock. No, Lisey. It was her own mind that sent the thought up, of this she was positive, like a flare into a dark sky. Well, almost positive. But it came to her in Scott's voice, as if it would gain authority that way. And it must have worked because... Yes, I'm here, deputy, was all she called back. Everything fine by? Okay, I mean. Five by, that's affirmative, she said. Amazed to find she actually sounded 5 by 5. Especially for a woman whose blouse was soaked in blood and whose left breast was throbbing like a... Well, there was really no accurate simile. It was just throbbing. Down below, at the very foot of the stairs, Lisey calculated, Deputy Alston laughed appreciatively. I just stopped on my way over to Cash Corners. They got a little house fire over there. Arson suspected. You'd be all right on your own for a couple 3 hours? Fine. Got your cell phone? She did indeed have her cell phone, and wished she were on it right now. If she had to keep shouting down at him, she was probably going to pass out. Right here, she called back. Oh, yeah? A little dubious. God, what if he came up and saw her? He'd be plenty dubious then, dubious to the nth power. But when he spoke again, the voice was moving away. She could hardly believe she was glad, but she was. Now that this was begun, she wanted to finish it. Well, you call if you need anything, and I'll be checking back later on. If you go out, leave a note so I'll know you're all right, and when to expect you back, okay? And Lisey, who now began to see, vaguely, a course of events ahead of her, called back, Check. She'd have to begin by returning to the house. But first, before anything else, a drink of water. If she didn't get some more water, and soon, her throat might catch fire like that house over to Cash Corners. I'll be coming by Patel's on my way back, Mrs. Landon. Would you like me to pick anything up? Yes, a six-pack of ice-cold Coke and a carton of Salem Lights. No thanks, Deputy. If she had to talk much more, her voice would give out. Even if it didn't, he'd hear something wrong in it. Not even donuts? They have great donuts. A smile in his voice. Dieting. It was all she dared. Uh-oh, I heard that, he said. You have a nice day, Mrs. Landon. Please, God, no more, she prayed and called back. You too, Deputy. Clump, clump, clumpity clump, and away he went. Lisi listened for the sound of an engine, and after a while she thought she heard one starting up, but very faint. He must have parked by her mailbox and then walked the length of the driveway. Lisi lay where she was a moment longer, gathering herself, then rose to a sitting position. Dooley had sliced diagonally across her breast and up toward the hollow of her armpit. The ragged, wandering gash had stiffened and closed up a little, but her movement tore it open again. The pain was enormous. Lisi cried out, and that made matters even worse. She felt fresh blood run down her ribcage. Those dark wings began to steal over her vision again, and she willed them away, repeating the same mantra over and over again until the world grew solid. I have to finish this. I have to get behind the purple. I have to finish this. I have to get behind the purple. I have to finish this and get behind the purple. Yes, behind the purple. On the hillside it had been Lupin. In her mind it was the heavy curtain she had constructed herself, maybe with Scott's help, certainly with his tacit approval. I've gotten behind it before. Had she? Yes. And I can do it again. Get behind it or rip the goddamn thing down if I have to. Question. Had she and Scott ever spoken of Booyah Moon again after that night at the Antlers? Lisi thought not. They had their code words, of course, and God knew those words had floated out of the purple on occasion when she'd been unable to find him in malls and grocery stores. Not to mention the time that nurse misplaced him in his smucking hospital bed. And there was the muttering reference to his long boy when he'd been lying in the parking lot after Gerd Allen Cole had shot him. And Kentucky. Bowling Green as he lay dying. Stop, Lisi, the voices chorused. You mustn't, little Lisi, they cried. Mein Gott, you don't dare, Inzi. She had tried to put Booyah Moon behind her, even after the winter of 96, when I went there again. Her voice was dry but clear in her dead husband's study. In the winter of 1996, I went again. I went to bring him back. There it was, and the world did not end. Men in white coats did not materialize out of the walls to carry her away. In fact, she thought she even felt a little better, and maybe that wasn't so surprising. Maybe when you got right down to where the short hairs grew, truth was a bool, and all it wanted was to come out. Okay, it's out now. Some of it, the Paul part. So can I get a smucking drink of water? Nothing told her no, and using the edge of Dumbo's big jumbo as a support, Lisi managed to pull herself to her feet. The dark wings came again, but she hung her head over, trying to keep as much blood in her miserable excuse for her brain as possible, and this time the faintness passed more quickly. She set sail for the bar alcove, walking her own back trail of blood, taking slow steps with her feet wide apart, thinking she must look like an old lady whose walker had been stolen. She made it, sparing only a brief look for the glass lying on the carpet. She wanted nothing more to do with that one. She got another one out of the cabinet, once again using her right hand, the left was still clutching the bloody square of knitting, and drew cold water. Now the water was running again and the pipes barely chugged at all. She swung out the glass mirror over the basin, and inside was what she had been hoping for. A bottle of Scott's Excedrin. No childproof cap to slow her down either. She winced at the vinegary smell that wafted from the bottle after she popped the cap and checked the expiration date. July 05. Oh well, she thought.
A girl's gotta do what a girl's gotta do. I think Shakespeare said that, she croaked, and swallowed 3 of the Excedrin. She didn't know how much good they would do her, but the water was heavenly, and she drank until her belly cramped. Lisi stood clutching the lip of her dead husband's bar sink, waiting for the cramp to pass. Finally it did. That left only the pain in her beaten-up face and the much deeper throbbing in her lacerated breast. In the house she had taken something much stronger than Scott's head bonkers, although certainly no fresher. Vicodin from Amanda's previous adventure in self-mutilation. Darla also had some, and Canty had Manda Bunny's bottle of Percocet. They had all agreed, without ever really even discussing it, that Amanda herself couldn't be allowed access to the hard stuff. She might get feeling yucky and decide to take everything at once. Call it a tequila sunset. Lisi would try for the house and the Vicodin soon, but not quite yet. Walking in the same careful, feet-wide apart way, a half-filled glass of water in one hand and the blood-soaked square of African in the other, Lisi made her way to the dusty book snake and sat down there, waiting to see what 3 geriatric Excedrin might do for her pain. And as she waited, her thoughts turned once more to the night she had found him in the guest room. In the guest room, but gone.
I kept thinking we were on our own. That wind, that smucking wind.
23. She's listening to that killer wind scream around the house, listening to snow grit whip against the windows, knowing they're on their own, that she is on her own. And as she listens, her thoughts turn once more to that night in New Hampshire when the hour was none, and the moon kept teasing the shadows with its inconstant light. She remembers how she opened her mouth to ask if he could really do it, could really take her, and then closed it again, knowing it to be the kind of question you only ask when you want to play for time. And don't you only play for time when you're not on the same side? We're on the same side, she remembers thinking. If we're going to get married, we better be. But there was one question that needed asking, maybe because that night at the Antlers it was her turn to jump off the bench.
What if it's night over there? You said there are bad things over there at night.
He smiled at her. It's not, honey.
How do you know?
He shook his head, still smiling. I just do. The way a kid's dog knows it's time to go sit by the mailbox because the school bus will be right along. It's almost sunset over there. It often is. She didn't understand that, but didn't ask. One question always led on to another. That had been her experience, and the time for questions was done. If she meant to trust him, the time for questions was done. So she had taken a deep breath and said, All right, it's our front-loaded honeymoon. Take me someplace that isn't New Hampshire. This time I want a good look. He crushed his half-smoked cigarette in the ashtray and took her lightly by her upper arms, his eyes dancing with excitement and good humor. How well she remembers the feel of his fingers on her flesh that night.
You've got a yard of guts, little Lisi. I'll tell the world that.
Hold on, and let's see what happens. And he took me, Lisi thinks as she sits in the guest room, now holding the waxy cool hand of the breathing man doll in the rocker. But she feels the smile on her face, little Lisi, big smile, and wonders how long it's been there.
He took me, I know he did. But that was 17 years ago, when we were both young and brave, and he was all present and accounted for. Now he's gone.
Except his body is still here. Does that mean he can no longer go physically, as he did when he was a child? As she knows he has from time to time since she herself has known him? As he did from the hospital in Nashville, for example, when the nurse couldn't find him? It is then that Lisi feels the faint tightening of his hand on hers. It's almost imperceptible, but he is her love, and she feels it. His eyes still stare off toward the blank face of the TV from above the folds of the yellow African, but yes, his hand is squeezing hers. It is a kind of long-distance squeeze, and why not? He's plenty far away, even if his body is here, and where he is, he might be squeezing with all his might. Lisi has a sudden, brilliant intuition. Scott is holding a conduit open for her. God knows what it's costing him to do it, or how long he can keep it up, but that's what he's doing. Lisi lets go of his hand
and gets up on her knees, ignoring the tingling burst of pins and needles in her legs, which have almost gone to sleep, likewise ignoring another great cold gust of wind that shakes the house. She tears away enough of the African so she can slide her arms between Scott's sides and his unresisting arms, so she can clasp her hands at the middle of his back and hug him. She puts her urgent face in the path of his blank stare.
"Pull me,"
she whispers to him, and gives his limp body a shake.
"Pull me to where you are, Scott."
There's nothing, and she raises her voice to a shout.
"Pull me, goddamn you. Pull me to where you are so I can bring you home. Do it. If you want to come home, take me to where you are."
24. "And you did," Lisi muttered. "You did, and I did."
"I'll be spucked if I know how this thing is supposed to work now that you're dead and gone, instead of just gomered out in the guest room. But that's what it's all been about, hasn't it?
All of this." And she did have an idea of how it was supposed to work. It was far back in her mind, just a shape behind that curtain of hers, but it was there. Meantime, the Excedrin had kicked in. Not a lot, but maybe enough so she could get down to the floor of the barn without passing out and breaking her neck. If she could get there, she could get into the house where the really good dope was stashed, assuming it still worked. It better work, because she had things to do and places to go. Some of them far places indeed. "Journey of 1,000 miles begin with single step, Lisi-san," she said, and got up from the book snake. Once more walking in slow, shuffling steps, Lisi set sail for the stairs. It took her almost 3 minutes to negotiate them, clinging to the banister every step of the way, and pausing twice when she felt faint. But she made it without falling, sat for a little while on the sheeted Mein Gott bed to catch her breath, and then began the long expedition to the back door of her house. Chapter 11. Lisi and the Pool.
"Shh, now you must be still."
1. Lisi's greatest fear, that the late morning heat would overcome her and she'd pass out halfway between the barn and the house, came to nothing. The sun obliged her by ducking behind a cloud, and a cap of cool breeze materialized to briefly soothe her overheated skin and flushed, swollen face. By the time she got to the back stoop, the deep laceration in her breast was pounding again, but the dark wings stayed away. There was a bad moment when she couldn't find her house key, but eventually her fumbling fingers touched the fob, a little silver elf, beneath the wad of Kleenex she usually carried in her right front pocket, so that was all right. And the house was cool. Cool and silent and blessedly hers. Now if it would only remain hers while she tended herself. No calls, no visitors, no 6-foot deputies lumbering up to the back door to check on her. Also, please God, pretty please, no return visit from the Black Prince of the Inkunks. She crossed the kitchen and got the white plastic basin out from under the sink. It hurt to bend, hurt a lot. And once more she felt the warmth of flowing blood on her skin and soaking the remains of her shredded top.
"He got off doing it, you know that, don't you?"
"Of course she did."
"And he'll be back. No matter what you promise, no matter what you deliver, he'll be back. Do you know that, too?"
Yes, she knew that, too.
"Because to Jim Dooley, his deal with Woodbody and Scott's manuscripts are all just... so much ding-dong for the Freesias. There's a reason why he went for your boob instead of your earlobe, or maybe a finger."
"Sure," she told her empty kitchen, shady then suddenly bright as the sun sailed out from behind a cloud. "It's the Jim Dooley version of great sex. And next time it will be my pussy, if the cops don't stop him."
"You stop him, Lisi. You."
"Don't be silly, darling," she told the empty kitchen in her best Zsa Zsa Gabor voice. Once again using her right hand, she opened the cupboard over the toaster, took out a box of Lipton tea bags, and put them into the white basin. She added the bloody square of the African from Good Ma's cedar box, although she had absolutely no idea why she was still carrying it. Then she began trudging toward the stairs.
"What's silly about it? You stopped Blondie, didn't you? Maybe you didn't get the credit. But you were the one who did it." That was different. She stood looking up the stairs with the white plastic basin under her right arm, held against her hip so the box of tea and the piece of knitting wouldn't fall out. The stairs looked approximately 8 miles high. Lisi thought there really ought to be clouds swirling around the top. If it was different, why are you going upstairs? Because that's where the Vicodin is, she cried to the empty house. The damned old feel-better pills. The voice said one more thing and fell silent.
So Weeza Baby Love is right, Lisi agreed. You better believe it.
And she began the long, slow trek up the stairs. 2. Halfway up, the wings came back, darker than ever, and for a moment Lisi was sure she was going to black out. She was telling herself to fall forward, onto the stairs, rather than backward into space, when her vision cleared again. She sat down with the basin drawn across her legs and stayed that way, head hung over, until she had counted to 100 with a Mississippi between each number. Then she got up again and finished her climb. The second floor was cross-drafted and even cooler than the kitchen, but by the time Lisi got there she was sweating profusely again. The sweat ran into the laceration across her breast, and soon there was a maddening salt sting on top of the deeper ache. And she was thirsty again, thirsty all the way down her throat and into her stomach, it seemed. That, at least, could be remedied, and the sooner the better. She glanced into the guest room as she made her slow way by. It had been redone since 1996, twice, actually, and she found it was all too easy to see the black rocking chair with the University of Maine seal on the back, and the blank eye of the television, and the windows filled with frost that changed color as the lights in the sky changed. Let it go, little Lisi. It's in the past. It's all in the past, but none of it's done, she cried irritably. That's the fucking trouble. To that there was no answer, but here, at long last, was the master bedroom and its adjacent bathroom, what Scott, never known for his delicacy, had been wont to call Il Grande Pupitorium. She set down the basin, dumped out the tooth glass, still two brushes, now both of them hers, alas, and filled the tumbler to the brim with cold water. This she drank off greedily. Then she did take a moment to look at herself. At her face, anyway. What she saw was not encouraging. Her eyes were glittering blue sparks peering out of dark caves. The skin beneath them had gone a dark blackish brown. Her nose was canted to the left. Lisi didn't think it was broken, but who knew? At least she could breathe through it. Below her nose was a great crust of dried blood that had broken both right and left around her mouth, giving her a grotesque Fu Manchu mustache. Look, Ma, I'm a biker, she tried to say, but the words wouldn't quite come out. It was a shitty joke, anyway. Her lips were so severely swollen they actually turned out from the inside, giving her battered face a grotesquely exaggerated come-and-kiss-me pout. Was I thinking of going up to Greenlawn, home of the famous Hugh Albernus, in this condish? Was I really? Pretty funny. They'd get one look and then call for an ambulance to take me to a real hospital, the kind where they've got an ICU. That isn't what you were thinking. What you were thinking. But she closed that off, remembering something Scott used to say. 98% of what goes on in people's heads is none of their smucking business. Maybe it was true, maybe it wasn't. But for the time being, she'd do well to take this as she had the stairs, head down and one step at a time. Lisi had another bad moment when she couldn't find the Vicodin. She almost gave up, thinking one of the spring cleaning girls might have walked away with the bottle, before finding it hiding behind Scott's multivitamins. And, wonder of wonders, the expiration on these babies was this very month. Waste not, want not, Lisi said, and washed down 3 of them. Then she filled the plastic basin with lukewarm water and threw in a handful of tea bags. She watched the clear water begin to stain amber for a moment or two, then shrugged and dumped in the rest of the tea bags. They settled to the bottom of the darkening water, and she thought of a young man saying, "It stings a little bit, but it works really, really good." In another life, that had been. Now she would see for herself. She took a clean washcloth from the rod beside the sink, dropped it into the basin, and wrung it out gently. What are you doing, Lisi? she asked herself. But the answer was obvious, wasn't it? She was still following the trail her dead husband had left her, the one that led into the past. She let the tatters of her blouse slip to the bathroom floor and, with a grimace of anticipation, applied the tea-soaked washcloth to her breast. It did hurt, but compared to the nettlesome sting of her own sweat, it was almost pleasant, in an astringent mouthwash on the canker kind of way.
It works. It really, really works, Lisi.
Once she had believed that, sort of, but once she had been 22 and willing to believe lots of things. What she believed in now was Scott. And Booyah Moon? Yes, she guessed she believed in that, too. A world that was waiting right next door and behind the purple curtain in her mind. The question was whether or not it might be in reach for the celebrated writer's gal pal now that he was dead and she was on her own. Lisi wrung blood and tea out of the washcloth, dipped it again, replaced it on her wounded breast. This time the sting was even less. But it's no cure, she thought, just another marker on the road into the past. Out loud, she said, another bool. Holding the washcloth gently against her and taking the bloody square of African, good ma's delight, in the hand folded beneath her breast, Lisi went slowly into the bedroom and sat down on the bed, looking at the silver spade with commencement, shipman library, incised on the scoop. Yes, she really could see a small dent where she'd connected first with Blondie's gun and then with Blondie's face. She had the spade. And although the yellow African in which Scott had wrapped himself on those cold nights in 1996 was long gone, she did have this remnant, this delight. Bool, the end. I wish it was the end, Lisi said, and lay back with the washcloth still on her breast. The pain was funneling away, but that was just Amanda's Vicodin taking hold, doing what neither Paul's tea cure nor Scott's out-of-date aspirin could. When the Vicodin wore off, the pain would be back. So would Jim Dooley, author of The Pain. The question was, what was she going to do in the meantime? Could she do something? The one thing you absolutely cannot do is drift off to sleep. No, that would be bad. I'd better hear from the prof by 8 tonight, or next time the hurting will be a lot worse, Dooley had told her. And Dooley had set things up so she was in a lose-lose situation. He had also told her to tend herself and not to tell anyone he'd been here. So far she'd done that, but not because she was afraid of being killed. In a way, knowing he meant to kill her anyway gave her a leg up. She didn't have to worry anymore about trying to reason with him, at least. But if she called the sheriff's department, well... You can't go on a bool hunt when the house is full of great big clutter-bugging deputies, she said. Also, I believe that Scott's still having his say. Or trying to. Honey, she told the empty room, I only wish I knew what it was. 3. She looked over at the digital clock on the bedside table and was astounded to see it was only 10:40. Already this day seemed 1,000 years long, but she suspected that was because she had spent so much of it reliving the past. Memories screwed up perspective, and the most vivid ones could annihilate time completely while they held sway. But enough about the past. What was happening right now? Well, Lisi thought, let's see. In the kingdom of Pittsburgh, the former king of the Incunks is no doubt suffering the sort of terror my late husband used to call stinky testicle syndrome. Deputy Alston's over in Cash Corners inspecting a little house fire. Arson suspected, dear. Jim Dooley? Maybe laid up in the woods near here, whittling on a stick with my OXO can opener in his pocket, waiting for the day to pass. His PT Cruiser could be tucked away in any one of a dozen deserted barns or sheds on the view. Or in the deep cut, across the Harlow town line. Darla's probably on her way to the Portland jetport to pick up Canty. Good Ma would say she's gone tooting. And Amanda? Oh, Amanda's gone, baby love. Just as Scott knew she would, sooner or later. Didn't he do everything but reserve her a smucking room? Because it takes one to know one, as the saying is. Out loud, she said, Am I supposed to go to Booyamoon? Is that the next station of the Bool? It is, isn't it? Scott, you goon. How do I do that with you dead?
You're getting ahead of yourself again, aren't you?
Sure. Carrying on about her inability to reach a place she had as yet not given herself permission to fully remember.
You've got to do a lot more than lift that curtain and peep under the hem.
I've got to rip it down, she said dismally, don't I? No answer. Lisi took that for a yes. She rolled over on her side and picked up the silver spade. The inscription winked in the morning sunlight. She wrapped the bloody piece of African around the handle, then took hold of it that way.
All right, she said. I'll rip it down. He asked me if I wanted to go, and I said all right. I said Geronimo.
Lisi paused, thinking. No, I didn't. I said it his way. I said Geronimo.
And what happened? What happened then?
She closed her eyes, saw only brilliant purple, and could have cried for frustration. Instead, she thought, Soweza, baby love. Strap on when it seems appropriate, and tightened her grip on the handle of the spade. She saw herself swinging it. She saw it glitter in the hazy August sun, and the purple parted before it, snapping back like skin after a slash, and what it let out wasn't blood, but light. Amazing orange light that filled her heart and mind with a terrible mixture of joy, terror, and sorrow. No wonder she had repressed this memory all these years. It was too much, far too much. That light seemed to give the fading air of evening a silken texture, and the cry of a bird struck her ear like a pebble made of glass. A cap of breeze filled her nostrils with 100 exotic perfumes. Frangipani, bougainvillea, dusty roses, and oh dear God, night-blooming cereus. Most of all, what pierced her was the memory of his skin on her skin, the beat of his blood running in counterpoint against the beat of her own, for they had been lying naked in their bed at the Antlers, and now knelt naked in the purple lupin near the top of the hill, naked in the thickening shadows of the sweetheart trees. And rising above one horizon came the orange mansion of the moon, bloated and burning cold, while the sun sank below the other, boiling in a crimson house of fire. She thought that mixture of furious light would kill her with its beauty. Lying on her widow's bed, with the spade clamped in her hands, a much older Lisi cried out in joy for what was remembered, and grief for what was gone. Her heart was mended even as it was broken again. Cords stood out on her neck. Her swollen lips drew down and broke open, exposing her teeth and spilling fresh blood into the gutters of her gums. Tears ran from the corners of her eyes and slipped down her cheeks to her ears, where they hung like exotic jewelry. And the only clear thought in her mind was, Oh, Scott, we were never made for such beauty. We were never made for such beauty. We should have died then, oh, my dear, we should have. Naked and in each other's arms, like lovers in a story.
But we didn't, Lisi murmured.
He held me and said we couldn't stay long because it was getting dark and it wasn't safe after dark. Even most of the sweetheart trees turned bad then. But he said there was something he wanted. Four. There's something I want to show you before we go back, he says, and pulls her to her feet. Oh, Scott, she hears herself saying, very faint and weak. Oh, Scott. It seems to be the only thing she can manage. In a way, this reminds her of the first time she felt an orgasm approaching, only this is drawn out and drawn out and drawn out. It's like all coming and no arrival. He's leading her someplace. She feels high grass whispering against her thighs. Then it's gone and she realizes they're on a well-worn path cutting through the drifts of lupin. It leads into what Scott calls the sweetheart trees, and she wonders if there are people here. If there are, how do they stand it? Lisi wonders. She wants to look again at that ascending goblin moon, but doesn't dare. Be quiet under the trees, Scott says. We should be okay a little longer, but better safe than sorry is a good rule to follow even on the edge of the fairy forest. Lisi doesn't think she could talk much above a whisper even if he demanded it. She's doing well to manage. Oh, Scott. He's standing under one of the sweetheart trees now. It looks like a palm, only its trunk is shaggy, green with what looks like fur rather than moss. "God, I hope nothing's knocked it over," he says. "It was okay the last time I was here, the night you were so mad and I put my hand through that dumb greenhouse." "Ah, okay, there." He pulls her off the path to the right, and near one of the two outlying trees that seem to guard the place where the path slips into the woods, she sees a simple cross made of two boards. To Lisi, they look like nothing more than crate slats. There's no burial mound. If anything, the ground here is slightly sunken. But the cross is enough to tell her it's a grave. On the marker's horizontal arm is one carefully printed word. Paul. "The first time I did it in pencil," he says. His voice is clear, but it seems to be coming from far away. "Then I tried a ballpoint, but of course it didn't work. Not on rough wood like that. Magic marker was better, but it faded. Finally, I did it in black paint, from one of Paul's old paint-by-number kits." She looks at the cross in the strange mixed light of the dying day and the rising night, thinking, as much as she is able to think, "All of it's true. What seemed to happen when we came out from under the yum-yum tree really did happen. It's happening now, only longer and clearer." "Lisi." He's hectic with joy, and why the hell not? He hasn't been able to share this place with anyone since Paul's death. The few times he's come here, he's had to come alone, to mourn alone. "There's something else. Let me show you." Somewhere a bell rings, very faint, a bell that sounds familiar.
"Scott?"
"What?"
He's kneeling in the grass.
"What, baby love?"
"Did you hear..."
But it stopped, and surely that was her imagination. "Nothing. What were you going to show me?"
Thinking, "As if you haven't shown me enough."
He's sweeping his hands through the high grass near the foot of the cross, but there seems to be nothing there, and slowly his goofy, happy smile begins to fade.
"Maybe something took it,"
he begins, then breaks off. His face tightens in a momentary wince, then relaxes, and he lets loose a half-hysterical laugh.
"Here it is, and damn it if I didn't think I pricked myself on it. That'd be a joke on me, all right, after all these years. But the cap's still on. Look, Lisi."
She would have said nothing could divert her from the wonder of where she is. The red-orange sky in the east, and west deepening to a weird greenish-blue overhead. The exotic mixed odors. And somewhere, yes, another faint chime of some lost bell. But what Scott is holding up to the last fading daylight does the trick. It's the hypodermic needle his father gave him, the one Scott was supposed to stick Paul with once the boys were over here. There were little speckles of rust on the sleeve of metal at its base, but otherwise it looks brand new.
"It was all I had to leave," Scott says. "I didn't have a picture. The kids who went to donkey school used to get pictures, at least."
"You dug the grave? Scott, you dug it with your bare hands?"
"I tried, and I did scoop out a little hollow. The ground here is soft. But the grass, pulling out the grass slowed me down. Tough old weeds, boy. And then it started getting dark and the laughers started."
"The laughers?"
"Like hyenas, I think, only mean. They live in the fairy forest."
"The fairy forest, did Paul name it that?"
"No, me."
He gestures to the trees.
"Paul and I never saw the laughers up close, mostly just heard them. But we saw other things. I saw other things. There's this one thing."
Scott looks toward the rapidly darkening masses of sweetheart trees, then at the path, which fades away quickly when it enters the forest. There's no mistaking the caution in his voice when he speaks again.
"We have to go back soon."
"But you can take us, can't you?"
"With you to help, sure."
"Then tell me how you buried him."
"I can tell you that when we go back, if you..."
But the slow shake of her head silences him. "No. I understand about why you don't want to have kids. I get that now. If you ever came to me and said, 'Lisi, I've changed my mind. I want to take the chance,' we could talk about it because there was Paul, and then there was you."
"Lisi,
We could talk about it then. Otherwise, we're never going to talk about Gomers and Bad Gunky in this place again, okay?
She sees the way he's looking at her and softens her tone.
It's not about you, Scott. Not everything is, you know. This happens to be about me. It's beautiful here.
She looks around and she shivers.
It's too beautiful. If I spent too much time here, or even too much time thinking about it, I think the beauty would drive me insane. So if our time is short, for once in your smucking life, you be short. Tell me how you buried him.
Scott half turns away from her. The orange light of the setting sun paints the line of his body, flange of shoulder blade, tuck of waist, curve of buttock, the long shallow arc of one thigh. He touches the arm of the cross. In the high grass, barely visible, the glass curve of the hypo glimmers, like a forgotten bit of trumpery treasure.
I covered him with grass, then I went home. I couldn't come back for almost a week. I was sick. I had a fever. Daddy gave me oatmeal in the morning and soup when he got home from work. I was as scared of Paul's ghost, but I never seen his ghost. Then I got better and tried to come here with Daddy's shovel from the shed. But it wouldn't go. Just me. I thought the animals, would have eaten on him. The laughers and such, but they didn't yet. So I went back and tried to come over again. This time with the play shovel I found in our old toy box in the attic. That went, and that's what I dug his grave with, Lisey. A red plastic play shovel we had for the sandbox when we was very wee.
The sinking sun has started to fade pink. Lisey puts her arm around him and hugs him. Scott's arms encircle her, and for a moment or two, he hides his face in her hair.
You loved him so very much, she says. He was my brother, is what he replies, and it is enough.
As they stand there in the growing gloom, she sees something else, or thinks she does. Another piece of wood? That's what it looks like. Another crate slat lying just beyond the place where the path leaves the lupin-covered hill, where lavender is now turning a steadily darker purple. No, not just one, two. Is it another cross, she wonders, one that has fallen apart?
Scott, is someone else buried here?
Huh? He sounds surprised.
No. There's a graveyard, sure, but it's not here. It's by the...
He catches sight of what she's looking at and gives a little chuckle.
Oh, wow. That's not a cross. It's a sign. Paul made it right around the time of the first bull hunts, back when he could still come on his own sometimes. I forgot all about that old sign.
He pulls free of her and hurries to where it lies. Hurries a little way down the path. Hurries under the trees. Lisey isn't sure she likes that.
Scott, it's getting dark. Don't you think we better go?
In a minute, baby love. In just a minute.
He picks up one of the boards and brings it back to her. She can make out letters, but they're faint. She has to bring the slat close to her eyes before she can read what's there.
To the pool.
Pool? Lisey asks.
Pool, he agrees. Rhymes with bool, don't you know?
And actually laughs. Only that's when, somewhere deep in what he calls the fairy forest, where night has surely come already, the first laughers raise their voices. Only two or three, but the sound still terrifies Lisey more than anything she has ever heard in her life. To her, those things don't sound like hyenas. They sound like people, lunatics cast into the deepest depths of some 19th century bedlam. She grasps Scott's arm, digging into his skin with her nails, and tells him in a voice she barely recognizes as her own that she wants to go back. He has to take her back right now.
Dim and distant, a bell tinkles.
Yes, he says, tossing the signboard into the weeds.
Above them, a dark draft of air stirs the sweetheart trees, making them sigh and give off a perfume that's stronger than the lupin, cloying, almost sickly.
This isn't a safe place after dark. The pool is safe, and the beach, the benches, maybe even the graveyard, but...
More laughers join the chorus. In a matter of moments, there are dozens of them. Some of the laughter runs up a jagged scale and turns into broken glass screams that make Lisey feel like screaming back. Then they descend again,
sometimes to guttering chuckles that sound as if they're coming from mud.
"Scott, what are those things?" she whispers.
Above his shoulder, the moon is a bloated gas balloon,